Welcome to a special edition of the Marketplace Roundtable podcast featuring Jay Mintzmyer of Value Investor's Edge. Jay first began contributing to Seeking Alpha in 2011, building up a large following through his work covering shipping stocks, probably about as comprehensively as they're covered anywhere online or in print. Since 2015, Jay has run the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. The service offers intensive coverage of deep value opportunities in the shipping, energy, MLP, and industrial sectors. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's Mintzmyer, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. And now your host, Jay Mintzmyer.
Good morning, everybody. Welcome to another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live. Today, we're hosting Textainer Group, CEO Olivier Ghesquiere and CFO Michael Chan to talk about the box lessor sector and specifically what Textainer Group stock symbol TGH will bring to that sector. Before we begin, I have a long exposure to Textainer, and nothing you hear on the call today constitutes investment advice or official company guidance. So Olivier, Michael, again, thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Pleased to join.
Thank you, Jay. Good to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, most of the listeners on the call today and on a recording later, for those who are joining us later, this is being recorded on the morning of September 28th, about 11 a.m. Most of the folks are familiar with the broad shipping markets. We're familiar with container ship lessors, how those sort of stocks work. But box leasing is a different business or a little bit different than those companies. So do you mind describing a little bit of how Textainer operates, the kind of the core business model, and what differentiates you from, say, something like a Costa Murray or the Naus Corp?
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, definitely. I think the business, you know, on the surface is a fairly simple business. It's all about supplying dry boxes, which are essentially just steel boxes, to shipping lines who are our main customers. Where the business model differs from ship leasing is essentially that, first of all, the container itself is very versatile. There's only one type of, there's only like two or three types of containers, unlike ships where you have different sizes, different engines, different configuration. With containers, you really have like one size fits all kind of model. So the asset is very versatile. Secondly, the asset life is also shorter than for a ship. Typically, a container's economic life will be in the region of 15 years. We do depreciate our container over 13 years. And that leads to a fundamental difference, which is that once the container reaches the end of its economic life, it gets disposed, and we usually realize a gain on sale because the asset is fully depreciated. So there's a very little speculation at the end of the lease. Another very big difference is that producing container is fairly simple. All containers today are produced in China because that's where the original demand is, and the cost of a container relative to transportation is fairly low. So it makes plenty of sense to produce it when you need a container rather than having to reposition a container to its first loading place. But the very important element here is really that the container. Excuse me for a minute. The container gets produced fairly quickly, meaning that adjustment in terms of supply and demand to the market are made very quickly. We have observed over the past 15 years that the growth in the industry has been consistently in the region of 5%. So some years it will be 7-8%, like this year, for example, is a very strong year. On a slow year, it will be, much, much lower. There may not be any growth, but over years, it is consistently been about 5%. Now, that means that supply, is adjusted to demand very, very quickly. And essentially, the game of a leasing company like us is to take advantage of the market when there's an upcycle and invest heavily to capture as much business when the market is ripe, and then to stop investing when the market is no longer there, and therefore taking the risk out of the business and making sure that we can offer long-term stable return to our shareholders. So essentially, a business connected to shipping, but a business that is probably a lot less volatile and a lot more stable than shipping itself.
Yeah, I think that was a helpful overview. You know, it's a similar lease structure, but it's not so much shipping. I mean, you're involved in shipping. That's the whole point of these boxes. But it's really more of a financial company and more of a financial model is what I'm hearing. And you know, it seems like there's less technology risk because you have this metal box. It doesn't change much. The technology hasn't shifted in the last 20 to 30 years. We don't expect it to change much in the next, you know, 20, 30 years. And at the same time, it sounds like in today's market, the stuff I'm seeing, and I guess we're here to talk about that today, we're seeing these long duration leases that seem to be for basically the entire life of the box. So it seems like there's not a whole lot of tail risk. Can we talk about that a little bit? What's going on in today's market? How have these leasing terms changed versus what you saw maybe 2 years ago?
Well, something fundamental has really happened. You know, as I was saying, really the business model is all about trying to ride the cycle and locking those containers on long-term lease. However, you know, historically, leases were concluded for durations in the region of 5 to 7 years, which meant that on a down cycle, there was always a little bit of an exposure of some of those containers coming back at the same time and having the utilization rate dropping. What's happened in the recent cycle, which really all started with the beginning of COVID, is that container price started rising substantially. And in response to that, you know, in previous up cycles, we would have had an environment where leasing companies would have increased yields tremendously to sort of like take advantage of the market. In this cycle, what we have seen is we have seen yields rising, but they haven't risen as much as before. In a typical environment, just to give a few numbers out there, a cash-on-cash yield, which is the revenue that the asset generates compared to its acquisition cost over the first year, was in the region of, you know, or is in the region of 10%. In the previous upcycle, that would shoot up to 13%, perhaps 14%. In this cycle, we've seen the yield increasing, but only to about 11%. But the main difference has been that the maturity of the leases has lengthened tremendously. And that is really for two reasons. First of all, lessors are trying to cover themselves against the possible, you know, remarketing risk of those assets. And at the same time, because containers are more expensive, we have seen shipping lines, you know, who know that most of the time they will have a use for those containers for their entire life, asking, you know, to get a lower rate in exchange of giving us a longer maturity. So we have really seen maturity go up since the beginning of this year, or maturity is average maturity is in excess of 12 years, which really brings us very, very close to the full life of the asset. And if we look at the whole cycle starting in the middle of last year, it's in excess of 10 years. So we really have put on lease a substantial amount of containers, and all those containers are locked in for, you know, durations that are very close to the full economic life of the asset, which kind of ensures that the return will be realized and will be there over the life of the containers.
Yeah, I think that certainly makes sense. So we're not seeing, you know, gangbuster rates, or at least in terms of immediate yields, but you're de-risking the future by getting these 12 or 13, 14 year deals. So it sounds like the boxes that you're buying today, you're not going to be, you know, rechartering them or looking to sell them, divest them, whatever. until like the early to mid 2030s, which is pretty remarkable there. Can you talk a little bit about the financing structure of how these mechanics work? So you go to one of the Chinese yards. My understanding is there's only three manufacturers in China. You go to one of those three and you order these boxes, right? And then you fix them. You find a leasing deal with a liner company like MSC, for example, or CMA CGM. What sort of financing can you get on these boxes? Are you doing like bank debt? Do you do any sort of unsecured preferreds? How do you sort of construct that financing?
So Jay, let me handle that one. We have a variety of sources of good financing for containers. Containers are a really well understood asset from a financing standpoint. So we've got bank debt, asset-backed securitization, source capital that we can use. On average, we get about 80%, 80 to 82% leverage on our new containers that we buy from China using a variety of these methods. If you look at our whole portfolio, about 87% of our debt is also fixed rate as well. And that's important when considering that we want to lock in the rates, interest rates related to fixed rate debt, because it's supporting fixed rate leases long term as well. So about 87% of our debt's fixed with an average remaining 10 or 7 years, which is important because that really well matches the average lease portfolio that we have, which is 88% fixed, as well as has a tenor of about 6 years on average, which includes a lot of those longer tenured leases that Olivia had mentioned earlier. The backbone of our fixed rate program is comprised of asset-backed securitization, ABS debt, which is a really great financing structure that provides really attractive fixed rate pricing terms and long tenure as well. If you kind of look back since 2020, we've issued about $3 billion of ABS financing through now funding favorable CapEx opportunities and refinancing also higher priced fixed rate debt, the lower pricing as well. If you look at our latest deal that we announced out there a little while back, $600 million in size for an ABS deal. It's really attractive all-in pricing of about 1.99% with a projected amortizing tenor of about 11 years, which is pretty close to that lease tenor that we're achieving on the new CapEx and very attractive and locked in and short that profit margin between that fixed rate revenue yield and our pricing of debt. Yeah, ABS, again, very well established, reliable source of capital that we've tapped for multiple decades, actually. Most of our investors like this type of ABS investment. They comprise of the likes of life insurance companies, which like this very predictable level of cash flows that come from ABS investment. On top of that, you mentioned also other sources of financing. We can also source financing from our revolving credit facilities, which is supported by a network of over 20 banks that we've known for a very, very long time. Very good relationships there. Some relationships, I kid you not, go back over 20 years as well. So very well understood source of financing for boxes.
Yeah, thanks, Michael, for the rundown there. It sounds like I heard, 80 to 82% is the financial leverage in total on those boxes. But you've also been selling preferreds. You sold some prefs early this year, I believe at 7%, $150 million, and you just sold $150 million last month. I believe it was 6.25%. Are those preferreds considered to be part of that capital stack in that new build growth?
Yeah, we like our preferred. The preferred program is really important to our capital sourcing stack. So it's not counted as leverage from a GAAP standpoint, which is nice treatment for it, but counted as GAAP equity, so to speak. But we think that's very integral to our overall financing program. And we think of it as really a cheap form of equity, in short, which blends well with our overall capital sourcing. And a couple of benefits to that is that it really juices up our CapEx buying power. And some examples we like to use is this. So if you think of buying a new container, the original equipment cost of the container, how do we finance it? And one can almost look at pref as something like this. So let's think about the debt side of it. We lever it about 80%, let's say in this example. The cost of that is maybe, 2% fixed rate, long-term debt. And then what about the other 20% of equity? You can almost think of that as funded by or financed by, say, the pref, which is the low cost of equity. And if you think about that at, say, a 6.25 fixed for life dividend yield, and by the way, these preferred shares are perpetual, meaning there's no mandatory call date. If you blend that pref and that debt together, you get a blended all-in, so to speak, 100% financing cost of maybe 2.8%. And think of that and compare that against, say, the 11% yield that Olivia had mentioned earlier. You've got a very nice cash margin that we've got in there that's sourced by this type of financing, which includes the pref, which is a really important part of our capital sourcing program.
Yeah, certainly makes sense. You know, just so I can kind of step through the economics here, you talk about a 10.5%. I know it peaked at 11, but I think it's about 10.5%, you know, sort of cash on cash, basically like an unlevered sort of cash flow number or at least a metric you start with. Then you apply, you know, 80% of bank debt on top of that. You know, at your cost, I'd like to hear, you know, on a follow up, you know, what that is, I think it's 2.5%. And then you put, you know, maybe it's 15 or 20% preferred on there. It's, you know, 6.25 or 7%. What sort of levered like ROEs or like IRR type returns can you get out of that? Because, you know, in my head, I'm doing the math and it seems pretty enormous, right? You start at 10 and then you add all this cheap leverage on top of it. What does that come out to? So folks can think about, you know, like ROEs or IRRs or stuff like that.
When we compute, say, a levered IRR, we come to around a high teens at least area to give an indication on the return. So very happy with that by all means.
So whenever, you know, you're doing these life cycle leases, I know these ones are recently been 12, 13, 14 years. How do you think about the tail risk? Have you changed your depreciation policies at all, or are those still based on the legacy rates? And then how does that divestiture work at the end of the cycle? What kind of folks are you selling these boxes to?
Jay, maybe I can handle the residual part of it, and Libby could tackle the resale part of it. Yeah, so if you look at our residual values for GAAP purposes, for depreciation purposes, and we evaluate that every year with our auditors, there certainly has been pressure to move residuals up given where resale prices are, which are really dramatic and extremely high, well above our GAAP residuals. Having said that, we keep an eye on that and look at that on a long-term basis. So, you know, we'll evaluate it every year. We haven't changed the residual yet. But there's certainly some pressure to move the residuals up and maybe bring depreciation down. But the good news is that while we assess that, and it's a long-term view, and if we don't immediately change it and don't change it, it's a conservative view to where residuals are. But having said that, the good news is that there is upward pressure to move our GAAP residuals up and therefore bring down depreciation on a forward-looking basis.
So, I mean, I'm tracking what you're saying, but this is a little technical, right? So when you would, if you did adjust your depreciation policy to reflect the reality, right, you would bring in the auditors, you'd look at the historical comps and that sort of thing. But when you adjust these depreciation values, my understanding is that would increase your reported GAAP earnings. Is that correct? And is that the right way to think about those mechanics?
Yeah, that's right, Jay. So if we increase our residuals, our depreciation would reduce and the GAAP income would go up. Yes.
Yeah. And I can perhaps step in on the second part of the question, unless you want to follow up on this.
No, that's excellent. I was looking for you to talk about the follow-on customers.
Sure. No, I mean, there's a big secondary market for containers. I'm sure you're aware, and everyone listening on this call has seen containers being used as a temporary storage on farms or on construction sites. So that's typically the secondary market. I mean, as I mentioned, you know, we depreciate our containers over 13 years. We kind of sell them around 14, 15 years, which doesn't mean that, you know, containers can no longer be used. We have containers that are in working service that are well over 20 years. It really depends very much on how badly treated they are. But that also means that they have a secondary life. And as I was mentioning there, they get sold through mostly traders around the world. But we also have ourselves a big department that handles the resale. And I think that's one of our added value as a major leasing company. We have an entire team that focuses exclusively on maximizing the value of those secondhand assets. And yeah, they end up in all those area, you know, temporary accommodation, construction site. They also are used on domestic fleets. You know, when containers get a little bit banged up, they may no longer be suitable to be used on ocean transportation, but they can very well be used on domestic fleets. And they're also used very much for what we call in our industry last voyage, which essentially means they are used as lost packaging to destination where it would be prohibitive to bring the container out. Think about, delivering goods in Central Africa or in the middle of nowhere in Kazakhstan, when for example, the Japanese are selling secondhand cars, they put them into containers, ship them there. But the simple cost of bringing the container back to a major port is just so expensive that it doesn't make sense, and the container is then disposed and used locally. So we've seen sustained demand, and you know, perhaps a little diversion here to say that if there has been one market that's been hotter than the leasing market, it's certainly the resale market, because shipping lines and shippers are using all the containers now. There's been very, very little supply to the secondary market, and that market has been completely starved. That has meant that prices have shot up to extremely high level, and it actually shows in our results that we are realizing a substantial gain on sales on the containers we're selling at the moment. If anything, our problem is that we don't have enough containers to sell. We've actually gone as far as offering some cash discounts or cash credits to customers to kind of incentivize them to return the older containers. But that market, is still very hungry for supply, and you know, it will continue to remain very hot for a while.
Yeah, it's certainly interesting to see those skyrocketing levels on those older boxes, right? The 13-year-old, 14-year-old boxes that are available to sell. What is the sort of design life for those? I know, Textainer, normally you divest them 13, 14 years old, but how many years of service could they do? I mean, we have a lot of demand right now for these boxes. Can they do, 15, 20? What's kind of the average life?
You know, the average life is really depends on the use of the container. But to answer the question very simply, we do have container in our fleet that are still operated that are 25 years of age. So, they can go up to 25 years if they're on a proper route and they're not being banged up too much. Typically, we also take the view that once a container is kind of 15 year old, if we have an opportunity to sell it, we'd rather sell it and realize the gain. We free up the equity, buy a new container and start for a new cycle. That's why you will have seen in our investors presentation that the average age of our fleet is close to 5 years. So a young, healthy fleet. We believe that's the right way to manage this business, making sure that we always have good assets that are in good conditions. And, the other element here is that if we extend the life of our containers, we can, which is going to be very positive from a GAAP point of view, because those containers stop generating depreciation once they are 13 years old. But the issue is that they then will be redelivered when the customers really don't need them, which is usually in the down cycle, and that's not the optimal time for us to realize the gain on sales. So we rather remain in control, so to speak, and force customer to redeliver those containers progressively so that we can realize gain on sales and maximize that value at the exit.
Yeah, it's certainly very interesting. And of course, normally we probably wouldn't spend so much time focusing on kind of the niche tail end of the business. It's just, this market's much different, and a lot of the reported gains are generated right from these huge sales, because you have a fully depreciated asset. And in some cases, I've heard that you're selling these for more than they cost brand new, Is that correct? I heard that from one of the sources.
Yes, no, absolutely correct. That's one of the very interesting fact of this market, is that with new container prices having shot through the roof and demand really being so intense for limited supply of even a new container, what's happening is that there are shippers that are desperate for container, and that are also, frankly, given the very high ocean freight rates, totally capable to pay very high price and buying secondhand containers at more than the price of new containers. We have a situation today in China where, typically we would sell a high cube container for $6,000. Now, to give you a few numbers, that container was bought probably 15 years ago at $2,700. We lease it to customers for 15 years. It sits in our book for $1,400, and we're selling it for $6,000. So it gives you an idea of the magnitude of the profit margin we realize on selling our assets right now. Going forward, it's fair to imagine that the market will not remain as hot for very long. But we still think that with new container prices now much higher than they were historically, there will be somewhat a correction, but the secondary prices or resale prices will remain very, very high and allow us to realize more profit. Actually, what we think is likely to happen is that when the market normalizes, we are going to see shipping lines maybe returning some of those very old banged up container that they've kept in their fleet, by hook or by crook, because they really needed them. So those very old containers are going to come back. They will hit the resale market. They will not come back on the leasing market. So we will have a little bit more volume to sell. And because demand is still very high, we probably are going to see an overall increase in our gain on sales rather than a reduction, because whatever we are going to lose in terms of the value of the containers, we're going to more than gain by the increase in volume here.
Yeah, certainly interesting. I need to update my saying or my quote or my understanding that you're selling some of these old containers for more than twice what you paid for them 15 years ago. I mean, that's remarkable. It's obviously not going to last indefinitely, but hopefully you can sell a good handful of these during 2022. Look, I mean, the whole purpose of a leasing company is to sort of offshore some of the financial leverage that the liners don't want to have. It's also to give the liners flexibility. Right. Maybe the liner doesn't want to make a 15-year commitment to a box investment. Maybe they only want to make a 6-year or 7-year leasing commitment. But you just we talked about how in today's environment, you're doing 14-year leases. I mean, you're doing an entire life cycle locked up, like almost no risk to you, except, of course, the counterparty credit quality. But at the same time, if you think about it, you're taking away that flexibility, that optionality from the liner. And at the same time, I mean, these liner companies aren't stupid. Like, they see the economic returns too. In fact, I just spoke with a CFO from a huge liner company just last week, and they're investing in their own boxes. And he tells me, hey, it's a no-brainer. We're just going to buy our own boxes. Like, God bless the lessors. But, these returns are so good, we're just going to do it ourselves. So how do you get around that? Like you're obviously still growing. So like, how do you offer a value proposition to the liner companies? And like, what's kind of like your reason or your sales pitch, or like, how can you still carve out, business? Because normal economics, you would think, these returns are just too good. I mean, competition is going to eat you guys away.
Yeah, no, it's a very good question. Then thank you for bringing it up. I think it's really down to the fact that, yes, our business is an asset management business. There's a very big financial component. But too often, people tend to forget that there's a service element to it as well. And the service element comes into play in several factors. First of all, last year and at the beginning of this cycle, manufacturers were reducing production. And what happened is that lessors saw the market turning, perhaps, were much faster to react. I think the shipping lines saw it turning as even before the lessors. But, we pounced and we started buying containers before shipping line could react. And essentially, it meant that we bought the whole production forward for 2020. And when a shipping line wanted to buy containers, you know, there were simply no containers available. And that brings me to really the main component here. The main component is that if you speak to the CFO of a shipping line, as you mentioned, it's fairly easy for a shipping line to build a budget and to say, well, we have so many ships, we have so many slots. If we calculate the slot ratio, that is, you know, on average, say we need two containers for every slot we have on a ship. It depends on each trade route, very obviously, but, you know, shipping lines know how many containers they need per slot that they operate. They can just calculate very simply, you know, how many new containers they need to buy because they know how many containers they are going to retire. Where the game becomes a lot more difficult is for shipping line to know where and when they are going to need those containers. And remember, you know, there are three manufacturers only in China, but there's probably overall 10 different locations where shipping lines typically will want to have those containers delivered so they can load them immediately with cargo. And that is really where, you know, lessors come in to play because we provide fluidity, you know, to the market. We have containers that are available in stock at all those 10 locations, whereas shipping lines may have, you know, available stock in one or two locations, and suddenly they are short in one location. And that's where, you know, they rely on leasing company. Because if you understand the logic of a shipping line, they historically have always been struggling to lock in long-term contractual business. Typically, they have like 60% of their business on long-term contract, 40% is spot. And they really value the contractual business above anything else. So much so that when they have a shortage of container in one location, it doesn't really matter how expensive it is to on-hire container. At the end of the day, the cost of the container is a very, very small component in the overall cost structure of a shipping line. And, you know, I like to take the example of a pair of Nike. You know, the cost of transportation from China is probably 3 cents. If the cost of transportation doubles, it means it's 6 cents. But if you then look at how much is the cost of the container, you see that, you know, the cost of the container is less than half a cent probably in the overall cost structure. But all this to kind of explain that if a shipping line is short of container, and they can be short of container because there's fluctuation in demand, there's a cyclone that delays a few ships, there's an incident in the Suez Canal, as we've seen this year, you have a strike in Western Europe, you have you know, congestion in Long Beach, which means that the ship can't rotate as planned, and all of a sudden the shipping line is short of container in one location. That is when they are going to come to lessors for immediate supply. And, you know, that is why there will always be a need for leasing companies, because if shipping lines wanted to match this, they would have to keep huge inventories in all the ports all the time. And that would simply be, you know, more costly to them than to rely on leasing companies. So I think that the service element here is very important. And another point that is not frequently mentioned as well is what we just talked about, which is the end of life of the container. Not every shipping line is properly organized to dispose of their containers efficiently. The large lessors like ourselves, you know, we have a dedicated team that just do only that, which means that by optimizing the disposal of the container, we also can be much more competitive on the long-term cost of those containers. And, you know, the best proof of that is quite often our resale activity involves trading containers, meaning we buy containers from shipping lines, you know, containers at the end of their life, and we sell them at a profit on behalf of the shipping line, which I think also shows that dedicated specialists like leasing company can add value to the industry.
Yeah, it makes sense. You're providing a service. You have those depots around the world at the different ports, so the liners can, you know, swap in and swap out. some of their boxes and such. If they did that themselves, they would have to pay, you know, for the rental space and all those other sorts of things. So it makes sense. It's not just a financial play. There's services involved. It still seems like some liners are making a decision at this point, right? The economics are such that they are making a decision to buy some of those boxes themselves. You beat them to the punch in 2020. You've done a lot of growth in 2021. I mean, gangbusters growth in Q1 and Q2. I think you've already officially guided for strong growth in Q3. Is that growth now, is it sort of tapering off in these new build boxes, or should we expect similar levels, you know, for Q4 of this year, Q1 next year, and so on?
Yeah, let me come to the last part of your question. Just also big picture to say, is historically, I think a leasing company had sort of like 50% of their fleet owned, 50% leased. A little bit before COVID, it was like probably, you know, 60% leased, 40% owned. And then during COVID and 2020, we've actually seen like almost 2/3 leased and 1/3 owned. I think that what we are seeing right now, to your point, is more shipping lines, you know, because they're not so rich, their business is going so well, are buying a little bit more. So we're probably going to go back to a situation where I don't think we'll go back to 50-50, but we'll come closer to 50-50, probably something like 55% leased, 45% owned for next year. And you know, that allows me to come back to the second part of your question. Yes, we've had an absolutely fantastic year in terms of the amount of capex we have been able to deploy. I think that over the last 5 quarter, we've deployed so much capex that we now have fit by NBV. We have half our fleet locked into those very, very long-term leases. So we only really have half the fleet that are so-called legacy leases, but the other half is really locked in for their entire economic life. Going forward, we continue to see some requirement and some capex in the fourth quarter, in the first quarter of next year. We've recently concluded a few deals for the first quarter of next year. Probably a little bit of a slowing down, which, you know, is really to be expected, because this year is an exceptional year. To put things into perspective, we estimate that total production needs to be about 3 million TEU per year. This year, we will produce 6 million TEU. So it wouldn't be abnormal that next year kind of slows down a little bit to perhaps, you know, something in the region of 2 million TEU. As I explained, that's one of the characteristics of our industry. Supply adjusts to demand fairly quickly because the lead times are so short. Typically between order and delivery of a container, you have like 3 months, which is really, really essentially very short. But the other element here, looking at it from a financial point of view, is that with expensive container, we don't need to buy as many containers as we used to 2-3 years ago to deploy the same amount of capex. So I think that's another important element. But yes, this year, I think we have mentioned that you know, we are going to probably deploy close to $2 billion dollars of capex. It is very logical that next year it will be definitely less than that.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, the returns, as you mentioned, you've never seen long-term locked-in returns like this before. So you're focusing on that growth, you're deploying there. I mean, you've done a few repurchases over the past year, but mostly growth. Is it fair to say that once this growth tapers off, whether or not that's Q4 this year, whether or not that's middle of next year, that when this tapers off, you're going to shift into more of like a shareholder returns mindset? Is that fair to say? And if so, how do we think about dividend versus like a repurchase? Because you've done some repurchases, but there hasn't been a dividend at Textainer for many years.
Yeah, I think that's one of the specifics of Textainer in the industry, is that Textainer was always the industry leader until we hit a bad downturn in 2016 with the bankruptcy of one of our largest customers that really affected us tremendously. That is when Michael and myself came on board with a clear mission to turn the business around. But you know, Textainer has and was always a dividend payer, had been a dividend payer ever since it went public. The business model is ideally suited to be a dividend paying business. And the intention and the business plan has always been to get back to that situation. I think that, you know, we have made no mystery that that was the plan, that it wasn't a question of if, but rather a question of when. And I think that, you know, our priority has really been to deploy as much capex as possible, because ultimately that is what will generate cash flows of the futures, that will allow us to return capital and equity to investors. I think we are at this situation with much, much improved performance. It was visible in the past quarter. It will continue to be very visible in the coming quarter, that, you know, we are now in a position where dividend are becoming much more obvious. We also believe that resuming paying a dividend will allow for some longer term investor to start investing in Textainer again. In terms of our investors pool, we have, some of you may know, a dual listing in South Africa, where we have South African institutional investors that have the benefit of that listing because it counts as a domestic investment. They've stuck with us, you know, throughout the cycle. They understand the business very well. But what we would like to do is to have a long-term investor of the same nature over here in the States as well. So dividend is definitely on the agenda. Dividend doesn't mean that we will not continue our buyback program. I think you are aware that we have bought close to 15% of our stocks since we initiated the buyback program. It's been a very successful program. We started buying really at the onset of the cycle, and it's been extremely profitable. But we don't see buyback and dividend as mutually exclusive. We continue to see a buyback as a very good investment for the company. As long as, you know, we're trading at 6 or 7 times a PE, when historically we were much closer to 15, we think that it makes a hell of a lot of sense to continue to do buyback. And, you know, on a lot of other metrics, I think that it's to us fairly obvious that buyback continue to make a lot of sense as well.
Yeah, certainly makes sense. And I know, you know, when we say dividends, right, a lot of investors' ears perk up, and folks like myself are very interested in the long-term allocation of the business. But at the same time, you know, we want the stock to get recognition, right, to be valued where it should be. And it just doesn't seem like, you know, the stock's done okay this year, but it just doesn't seem like it's lived up to perhaps the potential in terms of valuation. So this is a sort of new area for a lot of folks, both on the call today, for later on, for me, earlier this year, it was a new area I hadn't looked at. We're very familiar, obviously, price to earnings, price to cash flow, those sort of multiples, enterprise value to EBITDA. NAV is a big one in shipping. What are the key metrics for a firm like Textainer? Is price to book, is that relevant, or how should investors think about that?
Yeah, well, first of all, we have the operational metrics, which we tend to be focused on running our business. Typically, as a leasing company, utilization rate is a very important one. You know, as I explained, with expensive container, our utilization rate will remain very, very high. We also look very much at price of new containers, because the leasing rate is a direct factor of the price of new containers. So that's an important component. And we look at interest rate, because that's how cheap we can finance and optimize the financing for those containers. So these are really the operating, you know, ratios that we really focus on. Other than that, you know, we look at PE very obviously, historically, as I was mentioning, closer to 15 times. We kind of look at EBITDA multiple, which is our ability to finance the debt, essentially. We're a financial business, so it's all about cash flow. That's very, very important to us. And yes, we do look at the NAV as well, though sometimes it's a bit depressing to look at the NAV because it depends how you do your NAV, but you'd come to a share price which is probably closer to $100 and we're trading at the 35 today. So it gives you an idea of the undervaluation that we certainly perceive. To your question on price to book, I think to some extent, price to book is an element that has to be handled with care. I think it is somewhat relevant, but you know, one wants to be careful. Certainly, I would say at least this for a business that generates a 20% ROE or price to book should be much, much closer to 2x than where it sits today at 1.3x.
Yeah, it certainly makes sense. I mean, in shipping, I always tell folks price to book is like a worthless metric. At best, it's misleading, right? Because price to book is based on historical purchase prices and accounting depreciation, right? So if you bought all these boxes, you know, 5-10 years ago when they were very cheap or much lower than they are today, and yet today's rates and today's box values are much, much, much higher, you know, then your book value is understating things. Right. So I guess that's kind of like where we go with NAV. We're trying to like update that book value for, you know, the current market. So you mentioned, I mean, I know NAV's not really a metric we're going to use for Textainer. It's just a marker, right? That sort of NAV, like true up book, if you will, or whatever you want to call it, you mentioned it's around $100. Is that under the assumption that you would like basically, if you sold all those boxes today, is that kind of the assumption?
It's actually even a bit more restrictive than that. It's on the assumption that we would sell the container that we can sell today. But you know, the containers that are locked into a contract would still honor the contract. So we have, like, as we know, we have the 50% of our fleet that is those contracts we've locked in over the past 18 months. They would run their normal course, and we just do the NPV of those. And then on the legacy fleets, we would assume that they reach maturity of their leases, and then we sell them, right? And that we pay back the debt in line with that. So it's really like a milking assumption that we have done here. And as you mentioned, there are several ways to calculate, but that NAV would show quite a substantial value, and we believe it. You know, it's a very good marker and a very good indication of what the long term value of the business really should be.
Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, a lot of investors, they just look at price to earnings. And we talked earlier about how the earnings are artificially low because the depreciation policy is outdated, right? But so investors just look at price to earnings. They look at price to book and they see, you know, $30. It's not even 30. It's less than 30, right? Book value. And they don't necessarily know about like the $100 NAV equivalent. So how do you close that gap? Right, because I mean, yes, you're doing well, you're still growing, you're taking on some leverage, but how do you close that share gap? I mean, maybe we don't get to 100, but how do we get from 30, you know, $4 or whatever it is today, to 60 to 70? Is there anything else you can do? I mean, like in terms of more awareness, I know some investors have asked for, you know, can you do longer term projections of earnings? Is there anything, you know, you can take from that side?
Yeah, no, I think, you know, one of the issue we face is, as I was mentioning, is the turnaround story of Textainer. And just speaking around, even mostly to some of my close friends, they look at the share price and they say, oh, well, Textainer's up 75% this year. You know, the first reaction for somebody who doesn't really understand the business is to say, oh, well, 75%, it may have been a great stock, but I missed out on the opportunity. I'm not going to jump in now. It's too late. The business has peaked, which is actually the wrong conclusion, but I think a very natural conclusion for a lot of people. So I think that from our point of view, as I explained, I think that, you know, consistent earnings quarter after quarter is going to bring a lot more people on board, because they will come to realize that this is a long-term story. I think that resuming a dividend as well is definitely part of the game here, is to you know, convincing and demonstrating through the fact that you know, we can resume paying a dividend even though we are still investing very heavily in the business, and that we continue to see prospect for more growth. And then the communication strategy, I think, is very important. We recently hired a new investors relations director to help us in this task. We intend to multiply investors call, and do quite a few roadshow. Continue to perform is probably the first element here, and then communicate as much as possible about the strength of the business, the sustainability of the business, and the fact that we continue to see a bright outlook with continued growth.
Yeah, no, of course you want to focus on the business, but it is good to see you're doing that outreach and you're looking at that dividend. I certainly agree. I think bringing the dividend back will be a game changer for Textainer. I'm also interested, I mean, just maybe a note, but there's just a dearth of analyst coverage, right, of Textainer, but also your counterpart, Triton, TRTN. There's just not a lot of analysts covering this space, and a lot of the shipping folks don't cover you. A lot of the financial folks don't cover you, so you're not getting really much of that overlap. So anything you could do to get more analyst interest would certainly be positive. So we're nearing the end of our time. I appreciate you both joining us. As we close out, I really want to talk a little bit about we talked about why to invest in the box lesser sector. We talked about how cheap the stock is. We've talked a lot about the nuts and bolts of how this business operates. But look, there's two stocks out there. Really, I mean, there was three, and one of them got a huge takeover deal. So that was an interesting sign. But you have Textainer and you have Triton, TRTN. And I have a long position in both personally for my disclosure. But, you know, why should investors pick Textainer? What differentiates you from Triton? Because otherwise, you know, the instinct is, oh, I'm just going to buy both, or I might buy the other one. What's the difference here?
Well, I think, if I may say, I think that the value proposition from Textainer is probably more attractive because we, as I explained, we're really coming back from so far, and it's really the turnaround story. That's the first element. I think the second element is that if you look at the industry, and again, the industry is now well consolidated with a few players controlling 85% of the market. So it's a great industry to invest in. But really, Textainer is ideally positioned. We have the perfect size to continue to grow and focus on profitability. We really have the scale. We have 14 offices throughout the world. We're present everywhere where our main competitor Triton, who's double our size, is present. The fact that we are smaller also means that, you know, we don't have to grab every deal. We can choose which deal we want to take. We can focus on the profitable deal. We don't need to defend any market share. And I guess the other way to put it is that, you know, given our size, we have scale, but we can continue to grow consistently year after year, which I think is always highly motivating for the staff. But it's also great in terms of our net income to see the constant progression year after year, rather than be stuck in a situation where you're defending market share and you don't have this growth momentum that carries everybody forward. We have a situation where, if you look at our metrics, you know, we may be half the size of Triton, but our overheads costs relative to revenue are below Triton. Our average interest rate is also, our financing rate is also below Triton. We think that, you know, we don't want to only compare ourselves to Triton, but that's the only one that's public right now. So that's kind of the only metrics. I think that in all fairness, Triton and Textainer are both fantastic businesses, and certainly the two listed peers are the two better player out there. You know, there's a few other large players, but I would say that, you know, the two listed ones are really the two good players in this industry. You know, and overall, I think that, you know, we are in that situation that we have a great relationship with long-term customers that have stuck with us. We used to be the industry leader. That relationship is still there. And the fact that we have a light overhead structure, light management structure, I think also gives us, honestly, a great benefit in terms of our ability to move fast and to be reactive and to have a relationship with the large customer at a very senior level, at a very personal level. And longer term, that's a great benefit that we have as Textainer.
Yeah, thank you, Olivier. It certainly makes sense. And I'm glad to hear I don't need to rush out and sell all my Triton shares. So
absolutely not.
I'll be in good hands with both here. But I certainly do agree with many of the points you made. And you know, I have come to similar conclusions on the percentage of growth. I think Textainer is very well positioned here as the roles continue to go. We expect to see much larger earnings. So the big takeaway that you know I saw here, besides the economics that we covered in depth, is the potential for the return of a dividend. And I think that's something that that really makes folks pay attention. It really sends a strong signal. So with my piece of advocacy, unsolicited advice, I would encourage you to go as soon as possible on that dividend, even if it's as soon as next quarter. I know you have a strategic purpose. I know you're guiding the company very deliberately, but I would encourage that dividend as soon as possible. With that, Olivier and Michael, thank you for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much, Jay.
Thank you, Jay. Good to be here.
This includes another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live, recorded on the morning of September 28th, 2021 at about 11 o'clock Eastern Time. As disclosures, I have a long position in Textainer, long exposure to Pure Triton, stock symbols TGH and TRTN. Nothing on the call today constitutes official company guidance or investment recommendations of any form. If you're listening to this recording at a later date, make sure you look for the latest disclosures.